This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Everybody, welcome back to a special episode of Milkshakes Markets Madness. We normally record this show at the end of the week on a Thursday, release it on a Saturday. With all the events that have gone on, which I'll recap here in a moment, we decided it was important to hop on here midweek and give you a bit of an update. Now, if you're new to the show, Milkshakes kind of sounds unusual, but Brent, my co-host here, came up with the dollar milkshake theory, which explains a bit of how the financial system works, and ultimately that the longevity of the dollar, or the dollar acting as the reserve currency, is probably going to outlast most people's predictions, and that definitely gets a lot of conversation going. And so that's a big part of the theme here is the financial system, hence the markets piece of the name. We talk about financial markets and the madness. Well, the madness, hey man, that's why we're here. And I can't help but think, Brent, I have the thought of the scene in the movie Airplane when the guy is like, I picked the wrong time to stop sniffing glue. So, hey, man, it's a mad world. You take it from here. What do you have to say now that we've had a bit of a couple bank failures? The Treasury and the Fed has kind of come out with this bank term funding program response. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, we touched on this, you know, on our show last week. We recorded last week on a Friday, and, you know, the Silicon Valley Bank had kind of gone down or was in the process of going down as we were talking. And a lot of the details have come out since then. And so, you know, obviously we encourage everybody to go back and listen to last week's episode, because we're not going to be able to go through all that again here. But, you know, it turned out to be a fairly monumental weekend. You know, one of the things we said last week is this could lead to some kind of a panic, but it might not lead to some kind of a panic. And, you know, we would just have to wait and see. And, you know, I think it's still kind of up in the air what this really means. I think people are still trying to digest it. But what I thought we'd do is just do a quick little overview of what happened, why it happened, and then kind of what the response was and thoughts on it. You know, essentially what happened was, Silicon Valley Bank was a bank, a big bank, did a lot of corporate work, a lot of tech companies, a lot of startups in California. I think it was the 15th or 16th largest bank in the country. And it basically got shut down last Friday, mainly because they did not hedge their interest rate risk. So what that means is when you give your money to a bank, they don't just leave it in cash. They go out and they either use that as collateral to make loans, or they invest it in things. And typically what they will do is they will invest it in quote unquote low risk assets like treasuries or mortgage backed securities or things that are guaranteed by the, you know, by the government of some kind and that have a zero risk weighting or a very low risk rating against their capital. And this is what happened is they went out and bought treasuries over the last few years. And then as interest rates rose dramatically, those treasuries fell in price. However, they didn't mark those bonds to market. They held them, they marked them at par, or they marked them at cost. And, you know, they didn't mark them to what the actual fair market value was. And that's perfectly legal. They're allowed to do that from an accounting perspective and from a legal perspective. The problem comes is when everybody shows up and starts withdrawing their money and they need to start selling those assets to raise the capital to return people's deposits back to them, there's just not enough money for everybody. And that's when a bank gets put into liquidation, and that's what happened. Now, typically what happens in that scenario is that deposits are insured by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. and they are insured up to $250,000. What happened here was, and typically sometimes a bank will come in and buy them, will buy the old bank for, you know, pennies on the dollar or whatever it is, and take over those deposits and honor those deposits. You know, they will get the bank's assets, the bank that they're buying's assets. And what made it interesting here is that we knew that they were going into bankruptcy, or that they were being shut down on Friday. We didn't know what the outcome would be. And by Sunday afternoon, the rumors started flying. Some people said they were only going to be, you know, backed up to $250,000. Other people said, no, they were going to be fully bailed out. Of course, at the end of the day, what they did, a couple things. They said all depositors would be honored 100%, not just the $250,000, but they would be insured for all deposits. And then the other thing they did is they created a new deposit facility for any other banks that ran into a similar situation. They could, you know, deposit their bonds at the Fed at par and take a 1-year loan against them. And they could use that as a way to meet capital calls, as opposed to selling those securities at a now reduced mark due to interest rates being higher. Okay, so let's break that down. Normally the way it's supposed to work is, like I said, is the FDIC comes in and insures deposits to $250,000. And the bank's executives, the equity holders, and potentially the bondholders get wiped out, depending on what kind of bonds they are. And that is what happened here. So in one way, it wasn't a bailout because it zeroed out the executives, it zeroed out the equity holders, it zeroed out, I'm not sure on the bonds, I think the bonds are trading around 40 cents on the dollar because they're not sure kind of the assets they're going to get. And they may have some different senior secured, you know, there may be a different bonds that trade different place in the capital structure. And from that perspective, that's the way it's supposed to work. But what is different is they agreed to insure all the deposits, you know, whether it was 250,000 or 250 million. And so that's got a lot of people upset. Now, a lot of people have said, well, if I don't have the number right for me. I apologize, but I think the deposits at Silicon Valley Bank were, I don't know, let's call it 120 billion or 100 billion or whatever it was. And the FDIC has around 120 billion in assets. So that can be used to bail out those depositors. So there's two things here that you need to understand is, number one, they are going above and beyond what the charter says. So from that perspective, you can say it's a bailout. But the process is working the way it's supposed to work. The amount is, you know, admittedly a little off because they're going above and beyond the 250. But the other thing is that, let's say it's 120, in assets that the FDIC has, and let's say it's 120 billion that Silicon Valley Bank depositors needed. Well, that doesn't complete, and let's say that those are the funds that are used. That 120 is not completely wiped out by the FDIC, or the FDIC's funds are not completely wiped out to get to make the depositors whole. And here's the reason why: is there is still assets from Silicon Valley Bank. It's just that at the pace they were on, they were going to get wiped out. And so just as an example, let's pretend that there was 100 billion in assets, there was 10 billion in equity, and there was $100 million in deposits. That's a liability to the bank. There's $10 billion in equity, and then there's $90 billion in assets. And let's say those assets, because let's say they were all in long-term treasuries and they're marked down 25%. So that $90 billion is now worth like $65 billion, right? Or whatever the number is. So it's the difference between the deposits and the assets, which the FDIC would have to come in and cover. So maybe that's 30 or 35 billion that comes out of the FDIC to make the Silicon Valley Bank depositors whole. So it is a lot, and it's a lot more than it should be, but it's not like all of the funds from the FDIC are being now drained in order to do Silicon Valley Bank. The other thing that they did that is above and beyond and is new is that they did this new term, I don't remember the name for it, term facility deposit or something. You know, and the reason they're doing this, and part of the reason they made Silicon Valley Bank whole. Again, you don't have to agree with this, but I'm just telling you why they did it. Part of the reason that they made them whole and they put this new term facility in place is the hope that this stems all further bank runs. And so that there is not a mad rush to the exits of other banks and their depositors pulling funds. And so, you know, the bailing out of Silicon Valley Bank, one, they didn't want to lead, they didn't want that to lead to contagion. And then the second, the part with the term facility for other banks is they don't want those banks to have a run on them. And now where I think it starts to get really interesting is if it were to become a bigger thing from here, if more banks start to fail, which I will argue that at some point they are going to start to fail. But if they were to start to fail and it were to require a bigger bailout, and let's say all of the FDIC's funds were eliminated through, let's say another 10 banks fail and it's $30 billion to each and now all of it's gone, right? And it would require some bigger bailout from the government. Well, we're up against the debt ceiling. So it would be, in order to do some kind of a bailout that would involve being paid for by Treasury issuance, you would have to get the debt ceiling lifted before that could happen. And so that brings the Congress in. So anyway, so that's kind of where it's at. The big deal about it is the moral hazard of it, right? They chose to go above and beyond what they were required to do. They bailed out a bank that was a bank to a number of corporations and a number of very wealthy kind of high-end one percenters. And they're not probably going to be able to do this for every bank. And so then you get into the question of, well, why did the 1% get bailed out and not the mom and pop get bailed out? So anyway, it's become kind of this. Oh, and then apparently I heard today, and I don't know whether this is true or not, I heard that there was a buyer for Silicon Valley Bank. The Treasury signed off on it and the Fed signed off of it, but the FDIC did not. And the FDIC follows under the Biden administration, and therefore that could be a problem. So again, I think there's a lot more to play out, but that's kind of went on. So now you've had three banks in the last week that went down. It was Silvergate, which was very highly exposed to crypto. And then it was, Silicon Valley Bank, which wasn't necessarily crypto, but a lot of technology and startup executives, some crypto. And then Signature Bank out of New York, which was, again, you know, a small bank, regional bank, but a lot of exposure to crypto. So that's kind of where it's at. I think this has a lot of implications going forward, but maybe I'll just stop there for a second and we can kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So for this episode, I'm actually standing up partly so I can show off my Enjoy Cash Flow t-shirt, which I think is somewhat fitting for what's going on. But after that intro, I feel like I need to sit down and partly digest it, catch my breath, and try not to pass out. I mean, there is so much to unpack in each part of that kind of dialogue you just gave there, that monologue of what happened. Because, yeah, it's a recap of what has happened. And I know you're summarizing it quickly, but there's so much of this, like, what if that you kind of grazed over. A couple of things I'll point out and then hand it back to you. One, the name of the program, I find this unusually ironic. It's called the Bank Term Funding Program, but the acronym is BTFP. And for anyone who doesn't know, a very popular acronym in the banking and finance space was BTFD, Buy the Effing Dip, because for so long there was this Fed put or this guarantee that, you know, eventually when things got bad, the Fed would come in and bail things out. And what's so interesting about that, not only just by itself is it kind of ironic and funny, and that's the only reason I can remember what the name of the whole program is, but the idea here of a bailout coming when things get bad was what everyone was for a very long time waiting for, and or kind of using as their excuse for having animal spirits in the market when you had these deeply inverted yield curves, you had kind of a bear market and a lot of these bear market bounces. And this is something at the start of this year, the drum you've been banging on for a really long time is that you could kind of have this bear market bounce, but eventually you know, we would see a larger correction. There's underlying fundamentals that were weak, and the overall market still kind of had this like, well, once it gets bad enough, the Fed is going to come in and save things. And it felt like that was the underlying bid. Now, to an extent, they were correct, but this isn't, you know, QE in the sense of how we know QE in the past two decades. Yeah. They're not going out and buying bonds. But, you know, one other thing I want to add before I hand it off too is I don't want to get deep in the weeds on it, but I do think talking about what QE is and why the Fed isn't printing money, because to some extent, when they go in and they buy mortgage-backed securities and treasuries at the volume that they were, especially mortgage-backed securities where they're artificially suppressing mortgage rates, they create these housing bubble environments. But all of that liquidity, it's not like the argument that QE is not money printing, it's just reserves and commercial banks need to lend. Well, yeah, but if the government's going out there and buying mortgage bonds at massive premiums, that liquidity flows to all the non-bank lenders and all the mortgage originators. And then all these houses are selling and all these realtors are getting commissions. And so all that liquidity does get pumped in. And so is anybody surprised that you have a 9% year-over-year CPI? But we are seeing some of that calm down. The CPI isn't crashing, but it's easing. And so is this, in the sense of what QE did to inflation, potentially inflationary? And in addition to the fact you've got a debt ceiling problem, is the Fed really, really pinned now? Because their real dual mandate and what Powell is on a mission to do is kill inflation. But do they kill the banks now in the process? Because that's really what happened here. Inverted yield curves made it impossible for banks to borrow short, lend long. Yes, this particular bank, Silicon Valley, took their hedges off. But as you're saying, you know, it's going to create a systemic element of weakness and or fear that probably leaves some of the smaller guys hanging out to dry.
Yeah. So this, to me, this is the big question. So far, what they have done is not QE. They haven't issued any treasury bonds to pay for this. They haven't given the banks any reserves, in exchange for the bonds. What they have, it's potentially QE-like, you know? If a lot of banks end up having to pledge their securities or their long-term securities to the Fed in order to get liquidity to meet mass redemptions, and then it becomes bigger, then it has the potential, you know, it has the potential to become, to force a return to QE. What's really interesting is so far, and again, this could change in 20 minutes, but so far the market has said, okay, the government did what they need to do. They seem to have stopped it. You know, banks sold off really hard yesterday morning. They've bounced since then. There doesn't seem to be panic in the market. The VIX was really high yesterday. It's come down a lot today. Maybe that is enough that it squelches the problem and it doesn't become some big return to QE. Now, there's a couple things. This branches off into so many different areas, like you just said. I'm going to try to keep this relatively simple. There's a couple things that are kind of hampering this. Number one is we had CPI come out this morning. CPI kind of met expectations. And based on what Powell said last week before this issue with the banks, I think today's CPI print would have been seen as very hawkish. And not only was 25 basis points on the table, but potentially even 50, because last week he said he was open to 50. Now the question is, can they still raise rates with what's going on in the banking system? And part of the answer is, well, maybe. If the market is so far taking it okay, maybe they can. And then the opposite is, well, no, there's no way that they can. You know, this is absolutely going to be a deflationary spiral as people run to pull their money. A bank run is deflationary. Just to be clear, a bank run is deflationary. The response to a bank run has the potential to be inflationary. But my point is that as of right now, we just don't know way this. We're not for sure which way this is going to go. That's the first part of it. The other part of it is that, we've got a situation where the banks that are still around. Let me back up for one second, because I know for a fact there's somebody out there saying right now, there is no way this is going to work. This is absolutely going to create a huge crisis. You know, this job owning is just ridiculous. I tend to agree with you, okay? For the people that are saying this, I tend to agree with you. However, never say never. It was about 10 or 11 years ago where Mario Draghi stood up in front of the world and said, do not fight us. We are very powerful and we will do whatever it takes. And believe me, it will be enough. And I was just like, whoever's doubting what I'm saying right now, I was just like them. And I said, there is no way this guy is right. This is the biggest bluff in history. And maybe it wasn't the biggest bluff in history. But 10 years later, Europe is still holding up. So I guess my point is never say never. Okay, so now let's go back to what comes next. I think this has the potential to be a short-term solution, but I don't think it's going to solve the overall problem. And that is that part of the reason that Silicon Valley Bank got in trouble was this whole mark-to-market on their long-term securities. Now, I found out something yesterday that I didn't previously know, and I thank Mike Green for this. He pointed out to me that banks have a choice. They can mark their bonds to market, and they can hedge them, the interest rate risk, or they can classify them as long-term maturity or long-term securities and mark them mark them to maturity. If you mark them to maturity, then from an accounting perspective, you can't. If you hedge, if you mark them to maturity and basically hold them at par and then also hedge, you cannot capitalize those hedges on your balance sheet as assets. Those have to flow through as an expense to the income statement. And so if banks now start spending a bunch of money to hedge their interest rate expense because they don't want to become Silicon Valley, and this becomes deflationary and interest rates fall a lot. Okay, this is where I need to back up. Interest rates had one of their biggest moves yesterday in history. In the last 3 days, the 10-year has fallen 10%. So these are huge moves in the interest rate world. So now if banks now don't want to become the next Silicon Valley Bank, so they go out and they start hedging their long-term securities, and then interest rates continue to collapse rather than go back up, they're going to have an added expense on their income statement. And when they do an earnings call, their earnings are going to be shown to potentially be falling because of these costs. That's not a good thing if you're trying to stop a bank run. So there's so many ways that this can go. And the other thing is that a lot of the banks that are exposed to this are small regional banks, small and medium-sized regional banks. These banks have been disappearing at a very steady trend for the last 30 years, and it's picked up in the last couple of years, mainly because they're getting squeezed. When I say squeezed, their profit margins are getting squeezed. So to your point, John, when you have an inverted yield curve and you can't, you know, lend long and pay short, how do you make money? So their profit margins are already down. But now, with the added regulations that go with all different kinds, you know, the Dodd-Frank Act, the Patriot Act, money laundering compliance, and all of these different federal regulations, the reason these small banks have been disappearing is the costs associated with those compliance initiatives are much higher for a smaller bank as a percent of overall revenue or assets than it is for a big bank like Wells Fargo or JP Morgan. So they've been getting squeezed out of existence, and then those assets flow to the big banks, and you end up with, you know, a smaller number of really big banks and a dwindling number of small local community banks. These hedging costs, if banks now look at this run and they say, holy shit, we need to go start hedging our interest rate exposure because we have these long-term bonds as well, it just adds to their expenses. And it squeezes them even more. And even if this bank run has been squelched by the recent actions, I think that we're going to continue to see bank consolidation. I think you're going to see a lot of these small and medium-sized banks go out of business, and we're going to march towards a handful of mega banks. And maybe we end up with just one bank eventually, and that's when they roll out the central bank digital currency. I don't know. This is where you start to get into the conspiracy theory stuff, but the point is that's where it's headed. You know, does it end up there? I don't know. No, neither does anybody else. But that's kind of the trend that we're on.
All right. So we mutually disagree with the Fed. Let's just put it very subtly like that. We're not a fan. And so for those who vehemently hate the Fed, central banking, policymakers, all of that, and they have some sort of decentralized utopian in their mind, we're not quite on that fringe of things, but I do like the idea of dancing on some of the conspiracy here for a minute, because even if it's not conspiracy, some of these things that, you know, conspiracy is almost just like Mark Zuckerberg's a lizard, right? Like, we're not going that far extreme here. I think bankers at that level tend to be sociopathic. I think they tend to be narcissistic. They live in a world full of hubris. And I think to a certain extent, there is no, as the joke used to be, I want more, and more was spelled, yeah, you know, M-O-A-R. And, you know, when you're a billionaire, what's a couple more billion? Like, when is enough and enough? And there isn't. It's about power, control. Now I'm getting a visual of Seinfeld, and they're playing Risk, and Ukraine is not weak, right? So it's one of those types of situations where they're playing a game just to win. And when I think about, you know, the point you made, so the company I run is a non-depository bank. We are a correspondent mortgage bank, and I know all about that regulatory pain, from AML anti-money laundering to all the type of disclosure and filing we need to do with Dodd-Frank, the complete nonsense audits that I go through every year that ultimately I believe are there just to squeeze out the little guy. And the ones that create the regulation are the big banks.
Absolutely. No question.
It's to me that, conspiracy or not, that's intentional to squeeze out the little guy. And like you're saying, since the 80s, I'll try to put up the chart you shared, we've seen this slow decline and decay of the regional bank, and more and more of this, like, getting into the too big to fail. But if you're a regional bank and you're watching this situation unfold and you don't have the proper hedges, or you're unhedged at all, well, you kind of been gifted, I think, a life raft, because putting hedges on now, it's closing the barn door after the horses are out. Like, I think you're, at this point, you're rolling the dice of there not being a bank run, because confidence has been restored by this reaction or this response, the BTFP. Because all the other factors involved, like, why draw more attention by putting on insurance that's going to cost you money and then make you look weak? Like, the bleeding's temporarily stopped. If confidence is lost again and there's a legitimate fear of bank run, you're done anyway. You're not going to, like you're saying, you're not going to get saved. They're going to go for the more systemic situation. The problem, as you've pointed out, with making that decision so early is that you create kind of a political narrative. And what's also interesting about that narrative, and I'll hand it back to you to kind of talk about that, but from a regulatory standpoint, Signature Bank, the New York bank that was closed, you know, you talk about the discussion that was had internally about how to save Silicon Valley Bank. Well, it didn't really feel like Signature Bank ever had that opportunity. But ironically, the I don't know if he's chairman of the board, but Barney Frank sits on the board at Signature Bank. Right. So the guy who wrote Dodd-Frank. So in addition to even that just being funny, it's like, is he a plant? Right. Was he put there? Because they kind of had relationships in the crypto world. And that's a whole nother kind of like component here, where you have all of these banks that have fallen first. Are they trying to get rid of the bad apples and slowly choke out the crypto and decentralized world so they can continue to control and absorb more power as this unifying global banking cartel? It feels kind of almost like a comic book in that kind of way. But if it's not, if you push that to aside, I mean, what a huge regulatory failure here, from the fact that you guys have, you know, there's professional short sellers that have been screaming from a cliff about these banks. And it just seems like it's either intentional or just a complete inexcusable oversight from the people who are supposed to be on guard watching this.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist or at least a crazy tinfoil hatter to realize this stuff happens, right? Big banks are the ones that help the government write the rules. And it's not unusual to think that if you are the ones writing the rules, you're certainly not going to write the rules to hurt you, right? And if you have the ability, you are probably, even if you try to be objective, are probably going to write them in a way that's somewhat advantageous to you. And if you're a psychopath, you're probably going to write them so that they're very advantageous to you. So I don't think you can just discount that as a potential issue. One thing that I want to go back, and this sort of touches on this, and I forgot to mention it before, is another thing that will squeeze the small and regional banks is that in order to pay for potential bailouts going forward, they are going to more than likely increase the FDIC fees that banks pay, right? That's the way they're going to replenish the FDIC fund after the using them for the bailouts. Well, who do you think is more likely to be able to afford the FDCI fees? Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Citibank, or you know the community bank in North Platte, Nebraska, or in Topeka, Kansas? The majority of it's going to fall on these small and medium-sized banks, and they're just going to get squeezed even more. That's not a conspiracy theory. That's just the way it is. The other thing that I would say is that let's go back to whether Powell will still hike or not. Whether to your point, a regulatory failure. I think it is a regulatory failure. So I'm not pushing back on that. But I would also say, since this has happened, before this has happened, there has been a lot of talk about Powell doesn't know what he's doing. He's going to create a disaster. The economy is going to slow down. We're going to kick it into the economy into recession. And he's off of his rocker. And, that Warren, Senator Warren from Massachusetts has kind of been all over this. And a number of other analysts and, podcasters and, gurus have been saying this. And this is where I somewhat disagree with them. I think Powell knows that if he raises rates, that bond prices fall. I think he knows that very well. And I think he knows that the way banks mark their bonds to market means that, if they were marked to market, their balance sheet would not look great. But the fact that they don't mark them to market means that there's problems that are hidden there. So I don't think that it's stupidity that led to this. I think it's arrogance that led to this. I think that central bankers are arrogant enough to believe that they can not only break it, but they can turn around and fix it, right? And so far, again, this is, Tuesday afternoon. This could very well change in the next 20 minutes. But so far, they've come out, they broke it on Friday, and they're fixing it. They fixed it on Sunday, right? Now, there's probably going to be 100, things that happen, unintended consequences that they also think that they can fix that they won't be able to fix. But again, I don't think this was a situation where the Fed is just clueless as to what's going on. I just can't get there. I don't think that they're that dumb. I think that this is part of the plan, right? I think they want to slow the economy. And they think they can do a controlled burn. Now we will see whether or not they can or they can't, but I think this is part of the plan. Now maybe it popped up in a way or it popped up quicker than they expected, but I don't think they are completely shocked by what has happened. And so I know there's many of you out there that are now saying, well, they shouldn't do this. This is not right. The moral hazard of it all. And I 100% agree with you. But what I would also say is if you're focused on growing your portfolio and getting through what is to come, the sooner you get rid of the words should have or should out of your vocabulary and just start focus on what they will do or what they won't do, you are going to be much better off. Because if you think they are going to just do the right thing because they should, because, there are these moral altruistic individuals, that's not the way the world works. So stop focusing on what they should do and start focusing on what they will do. And to the people that are out there saying they will bail everybody out, of course they will. That's why central bankers were created. They were created to step into the breach and fill the void. So to think that they're not going to do that is a bit ridiculous. They are absolutely going to do it. The question is, when will they do it? And I think over the weekend, they got scared enough that they were forced to act, right? When the system gets in trouble, they will act. Now, but I think they are so arrogant. I don't think they're stupid, but I think they're so arrogant, they might still raise rates, which, again, I'm not going to, the people who are saying this is ridiculous, I don't necessarily disagree with you. Maybe it is ridiculous, but I still think they might do it. Now, they might come out next week and just say, you know what, rate hikes are off the table. You know, clearly the economy's starting to slow down, and that's that. My point is only that we just don't know yet. And, you know, again, I made this point last week. Just because you see a headline, don't go all in on it. You know, I'm sure there's some headlines out there saying this is QE, the printer's coming back on, the dollar's going to zero, buy risk assets, gold's going to 10,000, Bitcoin's going to 100,000, stocks are going to the moon. You know, pump the brakes a little bit. We just don't know yet. Anyway.
So on that note, I think it's very important to bring attention back to the idea of don't fall in love. And we've been beating this the horse is so dead at this point. It's like, don't fall in love with these narratives, these ideologies. And we get it. Like we're very, very in agreement and empathetic with, you know, not liking how things are handled and how things play out and the response mechanism, but get rid of the, they should have or should vocabulary. And I would even go one step further and start actually really spending time thinking about what they have done, not even what they will do. Because right now, the overnight lending rate is mid fours, and maybe they do hike and they get to 5%. So a little bit of liquidity issue in the banking sector that's solved because they're allowing banks to pledge these assets at par. Maybe that's a big fat band-aid that solves this. And here we are, the central bank having all this room to cut when there really is something that's systemic. And maybe this is it. We don't know. But Take note of what has happened, because for 2 years now, people are saying they could never do X, Y, and Z, and they've already done it. So stop saying they're not going to do A, B, and C, because clearly your track record for predicting what central bankers can and cannot do is bad. So look at what they have done and start trying to kind of figure out what they can potentially achieve, or how other people in the market are thinking about what they've done and where their position is. Now, the point you made too about these FDIC fees, and we kind of talked about this slightly off air. I think there's a lot of political undertones here that can get very interesting, because these smaller regional banks are, let's just say, tend to be more in red states. And what any business is going to do when the cost of operating that business increases, you're going to pass it on to consumers. So inflation is already taking a big bite out of the pocketbook of this, we'll call it middle class. And now you're going to have the threat of bank runs as well as higher banking costs. And that puts more of this power into these larger regional banks, multinational banks that tend to be more coastal, blue state. And the demographic in those states are probably more capable of handling that. So what's going to get really interesting here is as this thing continues on, and even if it's a bit of a band-aid, this is already being politicized and used as a left versus right argument. So it's going to be a wild thing to watch, because although the Fed tries to pretend that they're neutral, they're 100% not. So not only are you dealing with debt ceiling stuff, which makes the Fed's job harder, you're also dealing with the politicalization of the monetary decisions that they're making. And so I think this gets really, really dicey for everyone involved. Even if you take the situation directly as it is, trying to fix this problem is not easy. But when you take all these other variables that are ultimately tying up their hands and or making it difficult for them to make the pragmatic choice because they're playing favorites, I think there's a lot of, like you said, unintended consequences and other things pushing and pulling on this that people aren't considering, because they just want to see the end of the dollar, the end of the hegemony, the end of the Fed, and their gold and Bitcoin portfolio go to the moon. And there's probably a lot of other factors involved here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think maybe a good way to wrap this up, because I know we've probably already gone a long time and we try not to make these too long. But I know there's also people out there saying, okay, well, Brent, we had this bank run and the dollar's down over the last couple of days. And, you know, the problem is here in the U.S., it's not overseas. Well, two things I would say. The dollar itself was down over the last couple of days, and that is because yields were down. The spot dollar trades basically based on, you know, a lot of times it's based on yields. If the expectation is that yields are going to fall because the Fed is going to have to reverse course or stop rate hikes, then the very near-term dollar, the DXY contract, falls in value because the immediate return you get for holding that security is now falling. However, future dollars in the form of bonds, 2-year bonds, 10-year bonds, 30-year bonds, had a huge move higher yesterday. One of the biggest moves in history. And if you look at the future dollars outside the United States, the price of dollars outside the United States, the euro dollar futures, had its biggest move ever, I think, yesterday. So the idea that there is a bank run in the United States, and that somehow means the rest of the world is immune to this problem, I beg you to dissolve yourself of that notion. For the good of you and your portfolio, please do not believe that. Again, you can think of whatever you want about me, but do not have that as a core belief of yours, because it will hit you upside the head like a baseball bat. This is not a US-only issue. This is a global issue. If you understand the Cantillon effect, the closest people to the money benefit the most, the people furthest away benefit the least. The good news for Americans, at least in the short term, is that we are close to the money. And if you had money at Silicon Valley Bank, you benefited because you were very close to it and they gave it to you. Somebody in a, you know, with a euro dollar loan in Thailand is a long way away from getting that bailout. Not that it's impossible, but it's a lot harder for them to get that bailout than for you to get that bailout. And that will have a dramatic impact on things in the years ahead.
So I think it's a good spot to end. Brent Johnson on bended knee, begging the world to just chill out. And look at it in a relative way, which is a big part of the conversations we're having here. You are the dollar milkshake theory man. But this platform has definitely given you an opportunity to show that you have a much broader and more grounded view. And I think you did a good job there at the end making that clear. So look, everybody, be safe. I don't think this is the end of the world, but perhaps the end of the world is just beginning. And keep a close eye on things and we'll keep you up to date. Brent, thanks for jumping on early in the week. Appreciate your views and I think everyone else will. And maybe we'll talk again here in a couple days.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, everybody.